Hello, and welcome to New Books in Eastern European Studies. I'm your host, Hugo Lane, and today I'll be speaking with David Crowley and Susan Reed. They are the editors of a trilogy of books that explore everyday life and socialism. Their final installment, Pleasures in Socialism, Leisure and Luxury in the Eastern Bloc, has been published by Northern University Press. How are you doing today, David and Susan?
Very well, thank you.
Glad to hear that. Glad to hear both your voices there. It's really a pleasure to have you folks here today. I've been so excited about the books you wrote ever since someone told me about them. And it's a very different kind of interview because you didn't write everything in the books the way most of the interviews that we do are. But I think that the three books you did, including the most recent one, which is the Pleasures of Socialism, is the main excuse for talking to you today, have been so enlightening that I'd like to hear first about how did you both get interested in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, and how did you get interested in consumerism and everyday life?
Susie, why don't you go first?
Well, I studied Russian at school, so I was already interested in it at that point. And I suppose it was because it was just such an unknown place. I mean, at that time, I'm talking about the 60s, you know, by the time I learned Russian, it was the 70s, but nobody really went to Russia. But my father did go when I was quite little. He went to a conference of psychologists at the end of the 1960s, and he went to Czechoslovakia at that time, and he came back with all sorts of interesting souvenirs from his trips. And I think that, you know, as quite a young child, I got interested in it at that point.
And you, David?
Well, I suppose I went to Poland first in the 1980s as a student on a short-scale exchange, and that was a kind of fairly exciting thing. Again, Poland seemed a kind of rather distant and even slightly, dare I say, exotic world. It was just after martial law, and it seemed to offer a whole set of interesting and kind of problematic questions to me that I wanted to explore and to have the opportunity to go back. So I got a scholarship in 87 and then again in 89 after I did my first degree as a sort of researcher and I spent some time there, and it was a kind of extraordinary moment for me.
I can well imagine, particularly in 1989, we missed each other. I was in Warsaw in 1985-86.
Ah, so you were just a year ahead of me.
Yeah, I guess. That was really the pivotal moment in my life as well. Although my father didn't visit the Soviet Union or anything like that, but as a young child, he had read an article about Siberia and taught me in a kind of Pavlovian way. When he would ask, where is it cold? I would say, Om Yakon. No, I would say, Yakutsk. And he would say, where is it coldest? And I would say, Om Yakon. So the interest in the exoticness that you're describing as well, Susan, is a bit I'm quite familiar with.
Yeah.
Now, what was your disciplines at this point? Were you both historians or were you art historians?
Well, I started off in modern languages. I did Russian and German at university, having spent a year doing fine art, in fact, but I then shifted to do languages. But then I went to do my PhD in America, and I did that on art history.
Okay.
I was trained as a design historian, which is a kind of specialism, I suppose, broadly within art history. But design history had a particular preoccupation, or does have a preoccupation, with ordinary things. So it has some of the methods of art history, but a kind of focus often on buildings or on material culture of everyday life.
And then that's, you know, these two influences bring you together to think about high politics and resistance to socialism, you know, or getting away from high politics rather and resistance to socialism. I mean, that was so standard at the time.
Yeah, I think Susie and I probably first met maybe in the context of art historians' conferences in Britain, where I think thinking about Eastern Europe was always seen as a kind of something on the edge, a little bit marginal and a kind of fringe activity. And I think some of our interests as well in everyday life, in questions of design, in questions of how people use their material world, also seemed perhaps a little marginal to art historians. And I think in some ways that may be where we met, but the interest in our work has really come from other fields, come from social and political historians, anthropologists, people working in literary studies. So I hope Susie would agree, but it seems to me that we've been able to move between different disciplinary fields because of this interest in material culture.
Yes, I completely agree. I think I couldn't put it better myself. And yet, at the same time, I think that the fact that we both come from visual studies, it is important that I certainly take my cue from the visual, and that's why I first got interested in these things. On top of always having been more interested in social, cultural history, I was never very interested at all in political history, but I was always interested in things like, you know, how people dressed and what their houses were like and the what kind of pots and pans they used and things like that. So I always had that interest in the more archaeological, anthropological sort of aspects of the past. But the reason I got fascinated in the particular kind of things that we began to look at was images and seeing illustrations in Soviet magazines that were kind of intriguing and didn't fit with the standard ways in which the Soviet Union was discussed at the time.
And now you were on the cutting edge, because now everyone's talking about material culture in this way. I mean, with the history of the world in 100 objects and things, it's been enlightening to me when I first read your book, and I continue to be enlightened the more I listen to people talk about material culture. So, but getting back to your trajectory, when did you come up then with the idea of the first book, which was Style and Socialism?
It was somewhere in the mid-90s. We met at a conference that was organised at Northumbria University by a colleague of mine, a historian, Tim Kirk. It was an urban culture conference, and that was somewhere like 95, I think, so a very long time ago now. David gave a very interesting paper there, so I started talking to him about it, and we just discovered that we were both interested in these aspects to do with material culture and consumption in the Eastern Bloc and socialist modernity, socialist modernism even, which was a term that nobody else, I think, was using at the time. But we both had this understanding that that was really a very exciting thing to look at.
And it took a little while, I think, to get the first publication together, because we spent some time, I suppose, trying to establish a kind of network of people who had some common interests, maybe not exactly mirroring our own. But when you look at the first book that we put together, it has really quite a diverse range of scholarly interest, Style and Socialism. So it has work by people who might ostensibly describe themselves as economic historians, Mark Pittaway, sadly, who's died, would describe himself, I think, perhaps as a labor historian. But we could find a commonality of interests in this question about really what does material culture do in terms of people's lives, and also this kind of question about how do these states articulate some kind of difference, some kind of political difference or not, through their material culture, and the question about modernity sits at the heart of that.
One of the things that I noticed about the books, and it, you know, as I went back and was reviewing everything, that from the very outset, you've always had historians from the region as well included, or not, well, scholars, I should say, rather than historians, who have been included as part of it as equals. And that's been nice, too.
Yeah, I mean, maybe Susie would say something about this, but one of the most impactful essays in the first book is by Yuri Gerchuk. Susie, perhaps would you fill in his background, because it's very interesting.
Yes, Yuri Gerchuk was a Soviet, a Russian art historian, design historian, which is quite a rare breed in the Soviet art historical establishment. he wrote both as a participant and retrospectively. So I'd met him and I found him very interesting while I was doing my own research in Moscow. And he was conducting archival research at the time, but combining it with his own memories of the developments in the 1950s and 60s, when he was one of the editors of the main design journal, Dekorativno Iskustvo. And he was an editor of that right from its founding in 1957 until it ended with the end of the Soviet Union. So he was in a very good position to comment. And as David says, that essay is one that has been used probably more than anything else in the whole book.
So the one end of the spectrum, you have this essay that really kind of combines the perspective of the present, but also powerful memory. I think the other thing we've tried to do, and this is more apparent in the later books, is to draw in younger scholars, people who, you know, come from the regions that we're preoccupied with, the former Eastern Bloc. And what's so evident is the talent of younger scholars who are coming through, who are very preoccupied with the same questions that we are. And they do really very, I think, serious and significant primary research. So to be able to, I think, in a way, create three books that have this function of drawing, being able to put different voices before an academic community, I think, if I might say, has been the thing that I'm most proud of.
Yes, and me too. Yes, I quite agree. And it was always an important aim of the, well, from the start with the first book, just to create a forum and also not to be too directive. We really wanted the diversity of different kinds of approaches and different kinds of voices. So we tried not to be too heavy-handed as editors, but to really facilitate what people were trying to say.
Yeah, and so an essay, for me, a very powerful essay, was written by Katerina Gerasimova.
Yes.
The Soviet Communal Apartment. And this is a really fantastic piece of scholarship that she did, really about the life of the communal apartment at the end of the Soviet Union and into the so-called New World. And methodologically, intellectually, and in terms of research, it's a really fantastic piece of scholarship. It taught me a lot.
I remember enjoying it. I haven't had a chance to get back to that particular essay, but these views of the world, you know, the shopping that you dealt with in your piece, mm-hmm. I was particularly struck with, and I actually used with students, undergraduate students, to get them to think about their own shopping. Now, did that start as a conference, or did you just go straight in to put it together as a book?
Well, we've often, in the course of the years, organized modest events, open events, public events, but not necessarily grand conferences, because clearly by bringing together scholars, bringing together different expertise, and of course, look at the geography of these books as well. They're really quite wide ranging. You get so much more by bringing people to the same space. So we've done that on a number of occasions, and that's really been a kind of a way, sort of part of our editorial process, really, is to somehow know these scholars, work with them. And we wouldn't make a claim on a community, but we can see other projects that have become spin-offs because of those relationships that have formed at those events.
Yeah.
How did you then, was there a direct line from the Stalin socialism to Socialist Spaces, which was the second book in the series?
We had the idea, it really did form while we were finishing Stalin Socialism, I think. I think we began to feel there were all sorts of different directions and questions that we hadn't yet finished with. And it was just really as we were completing the introduction, the final version of the introduction to Stalin Socialism, that we came up with this and realised that we had to, I think both of us were exhausted with doing Stalin Socialism, and yet we realised we had to do this second volume, The Socialist Spaces. Is that right, David? Is that how
I think that's very true, and I think that also led to the third volume in a way. We could see these kind of these questions that emerged through the process of our own writing and thinking that one book couldn't answer, and there's been a fairly organic relationship between the three books. I think, as a set, they form a kind of interesting body of knowledge.
How would you briefly, for our audience who hasn't had the pleasure of looking at the books, characterize the themes of violent socialism versus socialist spaces. Obviously, we'll come back to pleasures and socialism in a bit.
My feeling is really that Stalin socialism it was the first attempt to try and think about the role of material culture and to some extent the aesthetics of modernity in relation to the ideological priorities of the states in Eastern Europe, but also the interests of consumers. It's quite wide-ranging as a book. It contains material that I think, from a classic material culture perspective, it's a little unusual to encounter. Material culture as a subject, certainly in Britain, is very closely allied to anthropology and is well developed here. Now, in our book, there's an essay on cartoons, and it doesn't really focus on the materiality of the cartoon, but it's very interested in what a cartoon does in the world. And I think that's a key question for anybody working with material culture. What does this thing that's before us, it might be a table, a chair, a building, a monument, what does it do in the world? What kind of social relations form around it? But the first book has a kind of breadth that's really trying to say there is a lot of potential in this field, whereas the second book narrows its focus a little bit and thinks more specifically about space and about the ways in which space allows or encourages certain sorts of social relationships and political ones, or inhibits them. And quite often the book has a kind of a line that I think we have in a lot of our scholarship, which is it explores kind of counterintuitive positions and perspectives. So one of the essays in the second book by Mark Speed looks at a building, a pavilion for an international exhibition that was to represent the Soviet Union, and really explores how it represented a certain sort of intellectual dismantling of the Soviet Union. So it kind of reverses the expectations that one might have of that particular space. So there's a sense of a clarity and focus in the second book that I think also represents the scholarship in these fields, that when we started doing this work in the 90s, the scholarship didn't have as many models or paradigms to work with, but over time, the scholarship, as it speaks to itself, becomes richer, more complex, and has better tools to work with. Would you agree, Susie?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Yes, indeed. And I think that relationship between the two volumes is exactly right, that the second one was more focused. The first one was really to make the statement that we needed to look at these issues, and we didn't really yet know who was out there working on things until we began to work on that particular volume. By the Socialist Spaces, we had a clearer idea, and there just were more people who were involved in that kind of work. But the focus with all three, it was always important that we kept objects and images focal. And although not every single essay or every single author really did that to the same extent, it was still the kind of core of what we were trying to do, so that we weren't writing generally about consumption or about synthetics or whatever else, but really to have a sense of how those particular materials and images circulated and functioned and were used.
The images, yeah, there's lots of those. Of course, they're not going to be able to see them. There's lots of great pictures in these books, which is a nice change from a lot of scholarly books as well. And they do exactly convey that. Now, because we have a limited amount of time, and I do want to focus in on the most recent book, Pleasures and Socialism. I guess for one question I had, and actually Mary Neuberger, who's a contributor here, was wondering as well, was how come it took so long for this book to get out? You did the first two quite quickly together. What happened there?
Well, the first one did actually take a very long time. It went through a lot of editing processes, and it took really a number of years. I can't remember how many. But David, would you like to tell the story of why Pleasures took so long?
I'm afraid some of the reasons for why it took so long are just simply to do the vagaries of the publishing process. You know what it's like when you send a manuscript in. It goes out to readers. Sometimes those readers are very prompt and sometimes they're not so prompt. So I think that's part of the story. I think the other thing that we should say, and I say this with some delicacy, we took on work that we knew had tremendous qualities, sometimes by scholars for whom we had to do a bit of work, sometimes with the English expression, sometimes to help them develop the analytical tools that they were using as well. So I don't think as editors we simply passively receive material. We've been very self-consciously shaping these books and to a certain extent helping the authors shape their essays. And of course that takes time.
Yes, we did a huge amount of rewriting trying not to impose our own voices on those essays, but to really try and work out what they're trying to say. So that did take a very, very large amount of time. But we also hit a bad moment in the publishing industry, I think. So it was delayed in that because of that as well.
Yeah, but we would thank Northwestern University Press, you know, for the great support that they've given, because they booked this back this book very strongly, which is great news.
Yes, indeed, yes.
Well, and I think many, many other scholars are quite thankful to them as well as to you. Now, you know, I think that in some ways the pleasures in socialism, luxury and leisure and luxury in the East Bloc, as the book is called, I think really brings out more than the other to the extent to which we get a picture of what it was like to live in, thinking about socialism as real socialism and different from our lives, you know, the lives that we grew up in capitalism and the assumptions of what is the norm. And would you like to pick up on perhaps some of the themes or articles that you saw as you see as particularly getting at that?
First to say that as David said, we tend to take these rather counterintuitive approaches. And so to try and write a book about the Eastern Bloc in terms of leisure and luxury was in the first place. I suppose to some scholars or political commentators on the Soviet Union in the past would be throwing down a gauntlet. It seems quite a challenge to approach the social and cultural life of the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc precisely in terms of leisure and luxury when, you know, in general people see it as in terms of privation and shortage and work. So leisure and luxury were our starting points. We were interested in leisure, and there was beginning to be some good work on leisure and youth culture and tourism and that sort of thing. But we also wanted luxury because of the object base of luxury, the fact that luxury tends to be due with commodities and things and the way that the kind of meanings that are attached to those things. So that was our starting point. The pleasures title actually came later. In order to focus on the way that that both pleasure and luxury are experienced, that you can't, that the state couldn't impose meanings on them. We wanted to refocus on to the way that different people would use it and make their own meanings out of it in their own lives. Does that sound right to you, David, as a summary of where we came from?
Absolutely. I think the other thing we wanted to do as well was in the mental horizon of people when you talk about luxury, certain sorts of objects really emerge very, very strongly. And they're in the book. And I think that's important. So fur is in the book. And one might understand a fur coat as being a form of luxury. But I think given that luxury is a relative concept, it always stands in relationship to something which is not luxury. We were interested in objects that might not seem ostensibly to be luxuries. So there was some discussion of cigarettes and alcohol. I think we're also very interested in what a luxury looks like in this age of socialist modernity that Susie started our conversation by invoking. So the idea that synthetic objects, plastic objects, and the discussion of cars and objects that really come from the modern world, how might they be understood in terms of this discussion around need, want, desire, and pleasure? And that's really centrally important for us.
Yeah, I mean, again, as you say, these cigarettes, the, you know, very plain things, but they are part of life. And I thought the way that we get it, this paradox of cigarettes being so important to the culture, mm-hmm. and yet, in the article there where they're trying to curb the consumption at the same time and thinking about it. The cars, of course, I think almost anybody who's ever read about the former Soviet bloc is well aware that cars were hard to come by. And yet the stories that come out of that and how people looked at it and the desires to change car culture and their inability, again, this is one of the things that I think comes through all three books, is the state, on the one hand, the state that is trying to rationalize and come up with a rational view of everything, constantly being confronted with with the fact that it can't do that and being unable to think its way out of the problem.
Absolutely. I mean, material culture, objects, commodities, goods present this tremendous problem, particularly from the late 1950s onwards, as these states want to demonstrate their modernity. And it's as if one of the major fields in which their claims on the future can be made is through consumer goods. And yet at the same time, within the ideological view of the world that they subscribe to, consumption presents all sorts of problems about social distinction, about desire and the ego and so on. And this is played out in those objects. It's played out in the discourses of the objects, and occasionally it's played out in the material forms of these objects as well. And that's truly fascinating. And it's an important question for economic historians, social historians, historians of gender and so on and so on. So it's as if an object can really be somehow the point at which these pressures are all being brought to bear. And that's really what the book attempts to address.
Did you have a thought on that, Susie?
No, just admiring how cogently David put it.
Nice.
Well, let's talk, give some people a flavor of some of the issues that actually get discussed in detail by your participants. You have East Germany on sex and camping, and the way that erotica was created as a luxury good.
Mm.
That's one angle on that. And then you also have you do have, as you mentioned, fur. One of the things that, as I think about my own experience living in post-Soviet Ukraine, was even the woman who didn't have a full fur coat had at least some little fur around the collar or something. There was always an effort to at least demonstrate some quiet sense of luxury there in her coat. And Poland, when you get to that, even in 85, how fashionable the women were looking. And, there was definitely a clear sense of fashion that was going completely against the grain of what, we don't talk about it in terms of Polish style, but in certainly the way the Soviet Union was talking about style and fashion in the 1950s with the article on Dior in Moscow.
Well, if I could just make a comment about this this essay, this very good essay by Tikhomirova on fur. I mean, what she does for us as a reader is she identifies, as you've just done, this fur coat. And sometimes for her, it's a collar or it's a detail. And she asks this question, how did this object find its way into the wardrobe or into the life of the woman, or in some cases, the man who wore it? And she, I think, in a very detailed and precise way, talks through all of the different kind of chains of production and consumption in quite a nuanced way that allowed certain sorts of people access to certain sorts of fur objects and other people not. And so what you end up with in the smallest thing like the detail of a collar is this powerful social picture that describes the social and status hierarchies in the Soviet Union. And she does it by drawing attention to what seems to be a minor or an ostensible detail. And it's a very elegant essay.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And it works nicely as a complement to Larisa Zakharova's one, the one that you mentioned already on Dior, because Larisa deals more with the professional designer's perspective. So we've got the two sides of it. We've got the users and the designers. But in Larisa's case, she's dealing with how those designers are negotiating the position of being in the Soviet Union, but actually wanting to be fully recognized as fashion designers on an international level. So how they're trying to assimilate what's going on in the West, but to translate it into the Soviet terms. But sometimes actually they seem to almost forget where they are. In dealing with something like haute couture, how to Sovietize something which is surely appealing only to an elite. She deals very subtly with some of those negotiations that the designers had to go through to try and legitimate what they were doing.
Right, and she gets to that core problem that fashion is all about change. And if you're building the Soviet society, which is going to be a fixed final end, it's anathema, really, to the whole way of thinking about social, even as socialism is calling on the gods of production, but it's going to be a fixed production. It will be one way and one way. That's all we needed. Although, of course, there were changes. I mean, the original Volga looks different than the later mod Volgas that you can still buy today. I mean, there was change.
This issue about fashion was something that really intrigued us right from the start, from the Style and Socialism volume, that this sort of paradox that, where did fashion fit into this system at all? How could there be stylistic change? That was something I was already interested in relation to painting, because there was a lot of debate in the 50s about stylistic change. If painting was supposed to be a representation of truth, well, how could it change? Mm-hmm. But also there was concern about how could it be that in the Soviet Union fashion could be similar to fashion in the West? Why was it not more different? This was a real problem at the time. If you're trying to catch up and overtake Western standards of fashion, what happens then to having a socialist specificity?
A big problem, if it could be achieved.
Yes. But that was the sort of the area of negotiation that designers, but also theorists, were involved in. Surely they should have a quite different fashion. Surely Soviet fashion shouldn't look anything like Western fashion.
Your thoughts on that, David?
Well, I'm just thinking as well. I mean, that one of the kind of questions is, where is fashion located? And so Larisa, to a certain extent, is interested in the role of designers, and if designers are state-sanctioned. And there's, increasingly very good work on this kind of the official organization of fashion. It's also something that Ina Merkel describes in her essay, which focuses on East Germany. But of course, fashionability is not really something that one can decree. And so the books often try and take a kind of a bottom-up perspective as well. So in this volume on pleasures and socialism, we have Catherine Leboff's essay, which looks at the kind of lifestyle choices and the fashionable interests of young people working in the new town of Nowohuta in Poland. They're ostensibly the young people building socialism in Poland, and yet they're very attracted to Western styles of dress. So their fashionability comes from the kind of social formation that they are themselves. So you get this kind of rather interesting tension, I think, across Eastern Europe between a sort of state-sanctioned view of a kind of limited form of fashionability and then the everyday practices of people themselves. And there's clearly space for a lot of interesting tension there.
Yes, I remember pictures in Der Spiegel in the 1980s, I believe, of this was obviously before the wall came down, of apartments that were the couple, young couple, had done all their interior decorating using Western brands. You know, sort of like there would be a Western brand, collage of the of different soap products and things.
Yes,
it was this inescapability, the constant measurement of the West, and the inability to ever see come to their own. It's fascinating.
Yeah, although I think we've tried to push at this from different perspectives. So if I can just give you an example of, I think, what I hope is a kind of nuanced position. Because we've tried to work across Eastern Europe, so we're thinking about the People's Republics of Poland and so on, and the Soviet Union, the question about where is the West in a kind of cultural sense is a really interesting one. And when you bring the scholars together, like in the first volume we talked about Yuri Gerchuk, when he offers reflections about how did young artists and designers, or perhaps more generally consumers in the Soviet Union, understand the West, and I mean here some kind of code for modernity and consumerism, it's not necessarily the West as it might be constructed in kind of Cold War politics. It was very often Polish material, quite literally to the west of the Soviet Union, that provided some kind of models and paradigms. So the kind of the classic East-West dichotomy we've been trying to break down in some ways by trying to think about different kinds of East-East relationships. And this runs throughout the book. And I think it's something that other scholars have picked up on quite strongly in the work. And it's fantastic to see that being developed in other ways.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, I agree entirely. And my wife, she's a former actress based in Lviv in Ukraine. And she said to me many times that Lviv, which, of course, for Poles is a quintessentially Polish city, mm-hmm. was the city that was the go-to city when Soviet filmmakers wanted to use it, have a European city.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the role of the Baltic states, more generally in the Soviet Union, as places associated with leisure, or the location of the electronics industries and so on, all of that suggests kind of interesting nuances and differences that really need to be taken into account. And the kind of monolithic pictures that we've inherited from the Cold War that, sadly still students will kind of bring into class, as it were, those really need to be dismantled. And they are being dismantled by good research.
Yes.
No, I don't know if you've seen the new book on Lviv in the West. It's just come out recently on Harvard Press by William Riche. It's also going to be, it gets to that as well, rethinking. But getting back to our material culture, and also again this issue of communist officials and their way of looking at things, it always seems it's so frequently. They articulate wonderful ideas. The discussion in your article about shopping in Poland, David, it talks about, they're conceptualizing it should be an educational experience. Mm-hmm. I was reading recently David Ogilvy, and he quoted some Soviet writer about advertising with praise, mm-hmm. About just the idea of educating and getting people interested in the product. And yet then there was this disconnect between the ability to talk about it on the one hand as a conception, and then the way the store became a place of real power negotiations,
mm-hmm.
Which is not something I think you talk about too much in the book. Or in your article, but it's certainly one that anyone who had ever been to the former Soviet Union or in that former East Bloc, shall we say, in the era would be familiar with. I mean, it's quite a different story. As a friend of mine in Ukraine said when I showed up just a couple years after, been away for 2 years after the, immediately after independence, came back. And he said, you know, now the client is king in the stores, and that hadn't been before.
Mm.
But it's always, it was there, that strange power relationship constantly being there. Was part of that. And yet they were articulating it originally, the idea behind it. Yes, you have a desk so the person can show it to you. You can look at it. You get a good impression. You know, it couldn't have been better conceived, really.
Yeah. I mean, I think this essay that you're describing, which is about shopping, compares the experience of something that certainly in Britain we would call a department store, which has kind of echoes of 19th century service culture attached to it. The object is brought to you. But really, this is about control. And then in the latter part of the essay, it explores what seems, or seemed to me when I wrote this, you know, a long time ago, a paradox that the supermarket, this quintessential symbol of American consumerism, the supermarket was being built in Warsaw in the late 1950s. And I think for us, the late 1950s through into the early 60s, I mean, perhaps broadly the Khrushchev period, has been particularly interesting because all sorts of models and propositions were being developed and offered in that moment. I think a kind of sense in which something like a kind of an experimental culture starts to emerge amongst artists, architects and designers to try and rethink some of those questions. About, you know, perhaps the role of objects or the role of spaces. And quite often those artists and designers are not entirely antagonistic to the communist project. They see themselves as being reformers and attempt to somehow bring back the modernity that had somehow been squashed or extinguished during the Stalin years. But I think This period has been really at the heart of the books, even though the essays very often explore a kind of longer periodization and the ramifications of those new ideas. Would you agree, Susie?
Yes, absolutely. Yes. I mean, the 1950s and 60s are really very much the heart of, I think, both our interests initially. And although I'm certainly interested now in moving forward into the 1970s because there has been a lot of work done now on the 50s and 60s, but it's a fascination with that kind of, with exactly as you say. I mean, it's a renewed utopianism, a new optimism around ideas about the possibilities of technology and science, but also about the possibilities of Marxism, the idea of emancipation, and of the role of the material environment in that. And I think that's one of the things I find most fascinating about that period and the way that artists and people involved in the material and visual environment were debating those issues and trying to really think through ways that they could begin to make them a reality. Going back very often, reviving the ideas of the immediate post-revolutionary period, the 1920s.
Yes, yeah, that did, has come out to me as well, that, you know, that the centrality of the 50s and 60s. I even in another work that is not touched with this book, you see that again, it's now perhaps a bit of a cliche, but in that period of the Khrushchev era, there are a lot of people who believe that communism is reformable. It can be reshaped and is a superior way of actually organizing the world. And it's to go on to another cliche. It's not surprising then that our articles in East Germany, which are focused actually, I think, a lot on the 70s, are a place where that idealism is still resonating, where the people. You know, everyday people are still expressing faith in socialism, saying socialism should be this way. Socialism has to take care of the land, which is, I think, you know, getting to this breaking down of conventional wisdom, which treats the former Soviet bloc areas completely uninterested in environmental issues. How even, you know, in the 1970s and 60s, I believe, you're getting to see that. You know, people are saying we don't want this here. We want to have some wilderness.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think you're describing, obviously, this. There's a whole set of temporal differences between the experiences of these different countries and different regimes. And what you described there for East Germany is really, as far as I understand, not so much the case in Poland. That kind of sense.
So I would say it was, sorry, David, to break in, I would say that it was happening in the Soviet Union, in Russia at least, that the already... the 60s is a very interesting period because it's a mixture of this still is striving forward technological utopianism, but at the same time, there's beginning to be a very strong ecological and retrospective movement, which has different aspects to it. There's a very conservative, chauvinist aspect to it, but there's also one which is more about trying to build new relationships with the past, and that includes an interest in the environment and in historic preservation and in environmental preservation.
Well, you're right. What I meant was this the sense in which there was faith in the socialist project continues through East Germany into the 70s, but doesn't really have much strength in Poland whatsoever.
Uh-huh.
And what I think is kind of interesting is when you put these different geographies together, you get a chance to think about the different kind of phasing and the different temporalities of these cultures. And that's a great benefit to have these People's Republics sitting alongside the Soviet Union.
I agree. I think we tend to, you know, and I confess, you know, I got into, my interest began with a desire to stop seeing, in my case, Poland, as simply an appendage of the Soviet Union.
Mm.
But I have now for many years come to believe that we need to, by incorporating the Soviet Union in a class on Eastern Europe, we actually get more than if we just limit it to Eastern Europe.
Yeah.
Because, and you know, that is precisely right. Because you're seeing the different trends and how they interact with each other, which gets to, you know, if there's any place where we see those two converging, it's in Paula Brenn's piece on in this book on luxury, on the two different images of the shopkeeper, who's kind of radicalized in the Prague Spring era. And then the other dutiful, hardworking shopkeeper in the Husek era.
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely, you know, in the way that both were right in their time.
Yeah, she does this extremely well, and you end up with two. I mean, in some ways, they're sort of caricatures because they emerge in the context of television and soap operas. But within a caricature, there's a kind of entire hinterland of politics sitting there that Paulina really draws out very well.
It was very well done. I mean, as are so many of the essays here, and I do recommend everyone get these books, get their hands on these books if you want to understand what it was just like to be in these countries. I was reading the portion on cars to my father, who was a car nut. And he was absolutely delighted. He delighted, as I was reading it to him, to hear about all the things he had not known about Soviet culture and cars. I mean, it just, it takes us to a different way of looking at that world. We're getting towards the end, and I have a couple of questions. First, I'd like to get back to an issue you talked some about before, which is the editorial and collaborative process. I mean, generally, when I interview someone about a book, I'm interviewing a single author. They rarely ever acknowledge the editors. And not that I necessarily ask them to acknowledge the editors, so perhaps that's the interviewer's fault. But so to have two people who worked on this as editors, although obviously you contributed to the books as well, talk about that process, the collaborative process. You did mention that you helped rewrite articles, but always trying to keep the voices of the original authors. Talk about that, please.
Well, I mean, I could say that the Pleasures and Socialism has a kind of extraordinarily long introduction.
Yes.
Anthology, so it's a 15,000-word introduction. A lot of collections of essays will often have quite a minimal introduction that simply provides some kind of background and you're into the book. But we really believe that in these books we're trying to kind of gather material and help shape a debate. And so our work as editors is partly to contribute to these books themselves. And so if you take that long introduction, it's a kind of it's a set of reflections on the scholarship of the last 10 or 15 years, and it's an attempt to kind of sift through the good ideas that come from that and to put them under some pressure, to test them a little bit. That takes time. So Susie and I will work together and write together. We write usually in sections and exchange those passages back and forth. And I hope in the end that the writing is pretty seamless, that you shouldn't be able to tell what I've written and what Susie's written, because we both sign off these texts and we believe them to be the product of both of our work. And we have that benefit really of having, you know, different geographical interests and some different kind of expertises, but they should in the end seem like a one singular object. I hope you agree, Susie. You can.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, there were times when in the process of writing, which writing the introduction did take us a very long time, and I think partly because we were trying to work out our ideas while doing it, that our own ideas were maybe developing as we wrote it. And so we'd sometimes find that one of us would take a paragraph in a certain direction and then the other one would take it back. We ended up with a kind of seesawing, zigzagging process and had to then sit back and recognise that. And I think that happened actually probably even more. I think that happened even more with the first book.
Yeah.
There was one point when we realised, because we were coming from the different perspectives, in my case, from looking at the Soviet Union, David looking at Poland, that we were meaning different things. And we had to really stand back and clarify that. And I think that's where some of our insights came from, that process. But it's a very productive process, the whole writing and dialogue. I think it, in many ways it's much harder than writing solo. But I certainly found it very it took my thinking in new directions.
Me too.
Yeah, I have to say, as a reader, I wouldn't be able to say who wrote what.
Fantastic.
I just could give you that. Maybe if I'm not a textual analysis expert, but I certainly got the sense that, you know, it seems to be the desired intent of a seamless explanation of the issues that are involved, as appears to be the intent here. Beyond that, working with the different authors, I mean, you did say more about that earlier, but did you have anything to add about that?
Well, with that, we divided up the work on individual chapters that we would both then revisit all of them, but we'd work I worked with certain authors, David worked with others particularly closely, so we really got into their particular thought process, as it were, and to try and work with their texts, but sometimes we'd hit a really difficult problem and send it to the other one to try and unravel it.
Well, I suppose if I could give a word of advice to anybody who's thinking about putting together a collection of essays in this manner, the selection of the text from the outset and trying to think about the balance. So in our books, you'll always find geographical range and you'll always find a variety of approaches and different kinds of subjects being put under the spotlight. Now, of course, pluralism is a good thing and diversity is a good thing, but more than that, publishers, when they're presented with a proposition like these books, really want to see a book that's been edited in the fullest sense, so that it's a kind of intellectual proposition rather than just a kind of gathering of available material. And of course, conferences are often that. They have a slightly ad hoc feel. So that would be a kind of word of advice if somebody was thinking about embarking on this.
Yes, absolutely. And one thing I'd say about it is that you're also working, it's the art of the possible. So in areas where you're pushing at the boundaries of what's been done or what's been taught about. You can't, you know, this couldn't possibly be a comprehensive study of leisure and luxury. There's all sorts of objects we'd love to have included essays on, but quite apart from the size of the book, it wasn't possible because there was no one yet working on these particular issues. I mean, for example, it would have been great to have had an essay on perfume or on chocolate, but because there wasn't yet anything available that was at a sufficiently developed stage to include, we had to limit the scope and the range of what we could include in it. So it's also just trying to be representative and open up the questions, but without feeling that you've covered it completely. And after all, we want to leave space for other people to do that in future.
Well, I actually thank you very much, David, for giving that advice, because one of the reasons I like to do these interviews is to give scholars, particularly I assume new scholars who are, you know, sort of working their way through their dissertations and such, an idea of what kind of things they need to do, or even undergraduates, you know, who might happen on one of these podcasts, to think, well, what would I need to do to be able to carry on with work in this field or that field? What advice, speaking of that, beyond that specific advice about edited volumes, what did you find was most important to you as a young scholar? What advice, you know, now that you can look back on that as a somewhat older scholar, what is most useful to help someone get along and move into the field of East European studies?
What would you, Susie? Do you want to go first?
I don't know. I mean, I suppose because we made our mark with this, with the first volume. I mean, that's certainly very, very useful. I mean, one thing I found particularly valuable with the first volume was that it was disseminated quite widely in Central and Eastern Europe quite early on, partly because it was available as a cheap paperback. So it was very accessible. And that was really very important, I think, because it then meant that it was used, it was taught, and it began quite quickly to get drawn into the scholarship that was beginning to be produced from quite an early stage.
I was actually quite surprised when I got my copy of Pleasures and Socials to find it was hardcover.
Yes, I hope it won't always be. I hope it will become available as a paperback, because it really is important that these are teachable books, that it should be possible to set them to students and that people can own them and not just borrow it from a library.
Okay, so are you leaving this as a trilogy, or is this going to become a tetralogy?
There are lots of people now who are working on different questions that I think we opened up in these volumes, so perhaps we don't need to anymore. What do you think, David?
I probably agree. I mean, I suppose another sort of small word of advice is it is really a lot of work to organize a book like these three. It probably is quite close in terms of time and energy and commitment. Close, so it's not the same, but close to writing one's own book as well.
I'd like to emphasise that as well, that people often underestimate the work that goes into an edited volume, and partly because, maybe a conference volume isn't so much work, but if you really want to shape it, take a concept and develop it and shape it in the way that we wanted to do, then it's an enormous amount of work, and anyone embarking on it shouldn't underestimate that. Mm-hmm.
And what are you now working on, either individual? I mean, I think are you doing anything more collaboratively, or are you both going in different directions in the friendliest way, I assume?
There's no collaboration at the moment, but I'm sure we will at some point in the future.
Yes, I hope so. Yes. But at the moment, we're both working on our separate projects. I'm working on, I'm trying to finish a book which is about homemaking in Khrushchevki, the Khrushchev era. Prefabricated apartments. So it's about becoming consumers and also about the development of a sense of taste, the relationship between people's practices in homemaking and the prescriptions of authoritative advice.
Sounds most interesting. And you, David?
I'm working on an exhibition for Museum Sztuki in Łódź in Poland on electroacoustic music in the 1960s and 70s and its relationship to the visual arts. I'm quite interested in cybernetics at the moment. So that's quite a step away from the books we've been discussing today.
Sounds very interesting. I do thank you for making, both of you, for making the time available to be able to chat today about your books. And I do hope that in addition to encouraging people to read these books, that today's talk will inspire a few people to put together equally useful and groundbreaking collective volumes in the future.
I hope so.
Okay, well, thank you. And both to you, David and Susie, goodbye.
Thanks. Goodbye.
Thank you.
You've been listening to New Books in Eastern European Studies. I'm your host, Hugo Lane. We've been speaking with David Crowley and Susan Reed about their book, Pleasures in Socialism. I hope you'll join us again next week when we speak to another author about their book in Eastern European Studies. Bye-bye.